Okay, and this today is October 27th. This is lecture 16, titled The Strategic Nature of the Vietnam War, Part 2. Deals chiefly with Allied strategic thinking, that is the U.S., South Vietnamese, pardon me, other Allied forces. This is somewhat of a difficult subject for me. There are two handouts. One is a lecture outline and the other schematic showing the size of the Allied forces other than the Americans in 1967 at the height of the war. In this lecture on the strategic nature of the Vietnam War, as I say, is something of a difficulty for me. I can be classified, I suppose, as a Vietnam area expert or a political scientist or a sociologist, although I like to think of myself as a generalist. In any event, I'm not a military analyst, and I have difficulty in understanding the multidimensional, computer-based conduct of modern warfare. And certainly I am not a military strategist. That being the case, one might well ask why I have written so much about Vietnamese communist military machine and military strategy in general. The answer, I think, is found by looking back at the Vietnam War, at its nature, its course of developments, and its final outcome. I believe, as when I first went to Vietnam in 1960, that a person with a background in political science, especially in Marxism-Leninism, in social psychology, and especially in the communication of ideas, can better explain the Vietnam War than one who is schooled in military science. The Vietnam War represented something new in the world scene, a different concept of war, radically changed grand strategy. So knowledge of past wars, even great expertise in them, can be of little use, and it can be something of a blind or a barrier in understanding the phenomenon. Okay, this is on to Allied U.S. military strategy in Vietnam. Much of what I say in the first part of this lecture is drawn from the writings of Douglas Kinnard, K-I-N-N-A-R-D, Kinnard, a retired U.S. Army general, author of many works, most important being perhaps The War Managers, which he wrote in 1977. In the chapter titled Strategy of the War in Vietnam, he begins with a section titled Strategic Framework. In it, he notes that strategy has many definitions, as we have seen earlier in this class. The most relevant for us here is the one used by the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff in a memorandum of 1965. Strategy, said the Joint Chiefs, is the art and the science of developing and using the political, economic, psychological power of a nation together with its military force to secure national objectives. Strategy is the art and science of developing and using political, economic, psychological power of a nation together with its military force to secure national objectives. Military force is a major element, but not exclusive part of the total strategy. Actually, that says less than it seems to say. Kinnard lists four dimensions. The first dimension of our American strategy in Vietnam was operational. It's the first dimension of any strategy, also in Vietnam. Operational, that's a favorite term of the military, operational. It can mean almost everything that you do. The standard definition of operational is the movement of one armed force to overcome another armed force. Classic examples of this kind are the best campaigns of Napoleon, decisive victories, his skillful maneuvering of forces, and precise application of firepower. In Napoleon's time, that was what war was all about. And no one understood this operational dimension better than he did. As they say, operational is a favorite military term. Second dimension to strategy is logistics, logistical. Classic example, which Kennard uses, is General U.S. Grant's strategy in the American Civil War, by which he wore down and eventually overpowered one of the greatest Western armies of all times, Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. Grant overwhelmed this army because he understood thoroughly the complex logistical dimension of modern strategies. Third dimension is socio-psychological. It became significant with the development of total war in the late 19th century and more so during World War I and afterwards. Mobilization of the home fronts emerged as the key to victory. The society with the weakest home front will collapse first. Read the last chapter of the great World War I novel, All's Quiet on the Western Front, with its poignant description of the collapse of the German home front. Four, managerial dimension of strategy. This is also irreverently known around the Pentagon as the Harvard IBM dimension. More important here, even in organization and leadership, is the complex field of civil-military relations. This dimension, along with social-psychological dimension, is the critical one in understanding American strategy in the Second Indochina War, in the Vietnam War. We should recall here the advice of Karl von Clausewitz, the famous German theoretician, in his book on war. Have you all know who Clausewitz was? Well, he was a famous German statistician. Anyway, he's frequently quoted, and this is one of his most famous quotes, "War can never be separated from political intercourse. And if this occurs, we have before us a senseless thing without an object." The initial test for the embryonic American strategy in Vietnam came in November 1965, part of a first sustained campaign against the North Vietnamese Army. Units of the American 1st Cavalry Division met at Iadrang Valley, I-A-D-R-A-N-G, Iadrang. They met in a particularly bloody battle. U.S. military victory at Iadrang was significant for the American strategists. I'm not going into the history of this battle here. This is lecture, as I say, is about strategy only. But for American strategists, Iadrang Valley was very important. It derailed Hanoi's hopes for early victory, but more importantly to them, it gave the strategists a feeling of assurance that the first dimension of their strategy, operational, was on the right track. As a result, U.S. goal became to defeat the enemy rather than merely to prevent South Vietnamese defeat. When the decision was taken to send American ground troops to Vietnam in February of 1965, the war was just about over and it was just about lost. And the strategic choice the Americans had was either to just stand by and let the thing go down the tube, or to get in, intervene heavily, fully. And that, of course, was the fateful decision that was made. But the initial goal was really to prevent this crumble. It was, in effect, to prevent South Vietnamese defeat. After Iadrang Valley, which was about 6 or 7 months later, the goal became to defeat the enemy. Well, obviously, winning is different from not losing, which until that was the until the Iodran victory was the principal concern of American strategists. Now the objective was to devise the winning strategy. I can't help but be reminded here of the visit to Vietnam of Herman Kahn of the Hudson Institute, who was a mad Pentagon genius, singular figure, used to charge people $500 an hour for strategic advice, charged the Japanese $1,000 an hour. Anyway, he came to Vietnam and he gave a lecture to all of the ranking military foreign service people. And all that I remember of this really was he said to them, you must follow three rules here. Rule one is be a winner. Rule two is if you can't be a winner, look like a winner. And rule three is if you can't look like a winner, don't look like a loser. And everybody laughed. And thought that was very funny. Actually, that's the whole essence, I would say, of what we did in Vietnam, is the progression that we made. Anyway, under General William Westmoreland's strategic thinking, primary operational efforts went to destroying the Viet Cong's military capability through combat and through curtailing supplies. He also gave orders to ensure the defense of all the population centers under government control. This was not only a big task, but also one in more ways than one was a very fuzzy task. Later, in 1974, Kennard surveyed the general officers who had commanded in Vietnam. I think there were 115 of them altogether, and he talked to almost all of them. And he asked them all one single question. How clear were the objectives of the war? How clear to you were the objectives of the war? And here are some of their replies from some of the 115, I think it was. We intervened with no clear idea of where we were heading. We had to play it by ear. The objective was never clear to anyone. These are different people speaking. The U.S. was committed to a military solution without a firm military objective. The policy was attrition, killing Viet Cong. This offered no solution. It was senseless. In responding to this question, 70% of the generals said they were uncertain about the war's objective. Now, while it's possible for 70% of the privates in a war to be unsure of the objectives, Kennard says, how is it possible that 70% of the generals did not understand the objectives? This mirrors a deep-seated strategic failure, the inability of policymakers to frame tangible, obtainable goals. There is an answer to this, or at least an explanation, which you will get later in the course, but I think it's a very telling piece of research, and it's, I think, objective, it holds up, and it is a bit inexplicable. All right, the military conduct of the war. In 1966, what was General Westmoreland's strategy for the war? How did he conduct, influence American participation during the high tide of U.S. stay? Critical point to be remembered here is the constraint policy. There were many constraints in Vietnam. For example, places where firepower could not be employed. Most important check was in strategy was what was called territorial constraint. Military forces, American and Allied, could not operate in North Vietnam, neither until very late in the war could they operate in Laos or Cambodia. The constraints have the effect of reducing the scope of their mission to a rather technical one. This was certainly the military view. Compare that mission with one assigned, this is Kennard speaking, to one assigned General Eisenhower in World War II. Quote, you will enter the continent of Europe in combination of Allied forces, drive to the heart of Germany, and destroy the German armed forces. The military like clear-cut missions. They feel they deserve them, and in a way they do. The problem in Vietnam was there was not a clear-cut mission that could be given to them. It wasn't anybody's fault. It was the nature of the war. The strategy that Westmoreland developed involved three tiers of available forces. It was based on the success of firepower, as demonstrated at Iodrang. His problem was that he could not occupy all of the areas controlled by the South Vietnamese. Instead, he could only seek out the Viet Cong in selected locations. This was the origin of the strategy, which was called search and destroy mission. And it seemed appropriate for a war being fought in a jungle environment at the time. It was the strategy that the American units were committed to, and with good success, actually, at that stage of the war. They did face, however, the problem of territorial constraints. VC retained a very precious initiative in the broader sense. They were free to retreat into Cambodia at any time. This was known as the sanctuary problem. In almost all guerrilla wars, sanctuary is an integral part of the guerrilla strategy. It was true in Greece, where the guerrillas could retreat into Yugoslavia. It was true in Malaysia, where they could retreat into Thailand. There is a need for sanctuary to regroup. And it introduces a whole other dimension, of course, of international relations problems. At the end of the war, we solved the sanctuary problem in Cambodia by invading Cambodia. We never really solved the problem of sanctuary in North Vietnam. While the Americans conducted search and destroy missions, ARVN, the South Vietnamese Army, was assigned to protect the government-controlled area. It was known this was the task of the local militia, the RFPF, Regional Force, Popular Force, RFPF, RFPF they were called. These units were concentrated on local defense and on the pacification effort. For some oversimplification, this was the Westmoreland three-tier strategy. How did it all work out? Well, that's the subject of lectures 17 through 20. This lecture, as I say, is only on strategy. In 1970, there was a shift in General Westmoreland's strategic thinking and the strategy employed, and it changed even more with the arrival of his replacement, General Creighton Abrams, later that year. There was a document prepared for General Abrams by Colonel Donald Marshall, which spelled this out. Marshall was later at Cal, where we worked together on a couple of projects. He was a singular figure. He's a Harvard PhD anthropologist and a specialist on, he's an anthropologist who specialized in South Sea Island people during World War II, in Melanesia, Micronesia, and Polynesia, and then worked for Abrams in the Pentagon and Abrams brought him to Vietnam. And he first arrived, I remember we had lunch and I said, what were you doing with Abrams in Vietnam? I never heard of you. And I was there all that time. Well, I was working out a strategy. And I said, we didn't have a strategy, did we? He said, yes, we had a strategy. I worked it out. And here's a copy of it. It was top secret in those days. And well, I never found anybody who was there at the time when I was there, who had ever seen this document. So I don't know whether Marshall was conning me or what. Anthropologists are kind of odd people on this one. Anyway, he produced this thing, which was about in the circa 1960. It's been declassified, and all the historians now have it. I don't know what they're doing with it. Anyway, this really only applies to people who are interested in military strategy, which is mostly the military. That's not really a criticism. It's just in the Foreign Service, we considered ourselves professional civilians, and we had the sort of that usual admiration and contempt for military, the same attitude they had toward us. But we said, well, we regard you guys as our allies, like the Israelis or the Canadians, you know, not trust you too far. But first job I was back in Watwas, we were working for Henry Kissinger in policy planning, and we had in our office people from the Pentagon who were military, what were called the political military office, and they were there to keep eyes on we civilians in the State Department. Later, I was assigned to the Pentagon to a job which was to keep, as a State Department guy, to keep my eye on the military, or political military. But we got along quite well. Anyway, this is what Abrams, and Abrams was well thought of, I must say. I think he was, again, we civilians, began at our staff meetings and so on by saying, who is this guy Abrams? Well, he was at West Point, but he was practically last in his class. He was a tank driver and a tank commander, and you know what kind of mindset they have. So it was a kind of, you know, jokingly putting them down. What we noted, though, at first, incidentally, was that the war began to pick up. And we thought a great deal of Westmoreland because he looked like a general and he acted like a general and he talked like a general, and Abrams didn't fit that bill. But we began to notice that for some reason, maybe not who to blame, the war was beginning to pick up. With the Cambodian incursion, which came about a year later, several of us went out to the war room and sat in this little box watching General Abrams run this mission into 60,000 troops into Cambodia, running it by computer, in which the computer was telling every individual going in what he's to do, where he's to go, how long he's to stay, and when he's to get out. The whole damn thing was run by computer, and here was Abrams in the middle of this with computer printouts trying to explain to us, you know, between questions, what he was doing. And it was awesomely impressive to us. We didn't have a clue what he was doing, but it certainly seemed impressive. And it really turned our attitude, I think, around toward Abrams, and I came to know him quite well and liked him very well. And after the war, our wives were in Washington, and they set up a welcome home operation for Vietnamese coming in. A Navy officer rented a house in Arlington for $1 a year, and we were putting them in there. And we were meeting every... Abrams was dead by this time. But we were meeting once a week and trying to get these Vietnamese who were already there to take some responsibility for helping the Vietnamese who were coming in. And we agreed, Bill Colby was in this conference committee too, we are not going to do it for the Vietnamese. And they would tell us, you have to do it, we can't do it. And they'll say, you do it, or it's not going to get done. That's why you lost the war, because you didn't do it for yourself, and we're not going to repeat it here. And they did it for themselves, and they did it fairly well. Lesson learned through life, I guess. Anyway, Abrams is well regarded by the military. There is a plaque to him at Carlisle Barracks. And there's not a plaque there to William Westmoreland. I think there's some what the military think of him. But it's very hard to judge, especially as a civilian, to judge how good a general is. as Napoleon says, victor has many victory has many fathers, but defeat is an orphan. And everybody thought Napoleon was a genius until he started losing. But it's very hard, I say, for a civilian. I think it's very hard for the military too to decide what makes a good general and what doesn't. How do you judge him? If he wins the battles, then that's a traditional determination. He won all the battles, he won the war, so he's a great general. If he lost the battle, Eisenhower was a great general. Lee lost the war, so Lee, in some military thinking, was a bum. Not because he wasn't a good general, but because he lost. The military, they have this leadership problem all the way down. You ask generals like Abrams when he was having trouble with some of the American units. They weren't performing the way he thought they should. Now, this is usually at the company level. And I said, what do you do about this? He said, we go in and we remove all of the officers, every one of them, transfer them out, and move in a whole new set of officers. And that takes out the bad officers, it takes out the good officers, it takes out the indifferent officers. All we know is that it works better. With this new set of officers, things pick up almost every time. We don't know the reason for it, but we know the solution for it. I think there's something of that in leadership itself. Westmoreland's case, there was great disenchantment with him at the Pentagon and in Vietnam, but he was so continually attacked by the New York Times and the other press. Dave Halberstam kept saying, pull him out of there, pull him out of there. The story was that somebody finally called Scotty Reston, the New York Times, and said, we're trying to pull him out. If you people would shut up about it. Just give us a couple of weeks in which you don't say, pull out Westmoreland, and we'll pull him out. I don't know if that's a talkable story or not. But the Times did stop saying this, and they did pull him out. He couldn't be seen being pulled out in disgrace. I mean, he didn't deserve that, and the military weren't going to do it, and the Pentagon or the White House wasn't going to do it. It's a very muzzy business. Anyway, I digress. This is what was our strategy, our official strategy, beginning in about 1970. A U.S. military strategy does not and need not focus on destruction of the enemy, as it did in years past. Instead, it focuses on security for the people of Vietnam by keeping the enemy away from them. And this is part of the military aspect of Vietnamization. Our military strategy is to assist the Vietnamese military and civil forces in providing effective security for the Vietnamese people. Area security, and this is a key word, like operational, this is a key word in after 19th, area security. Everything is in terms of area security. Area security is executed through operations and activities that consist of five things. One, improve regular military performance. Improve paramilitary and civil forces. Two, assist other pacification and development programs, as assist the economic aid program. Medical care, building schools, digging wells, and so on. Three, interdict the flow of enemy troops and material into Vietnam, using limited Vietnamese cross-border operations into Laos, Cambodia, North Vietnam. This, of course, was top secret at the time it was issued. And we were doing these things, and we were denying we were doing those things. But that's a part of the deception of warfare. Four, eliminate enemy forces in Vietnam and neutralize enemy base areas. And five, isolate and neutralize subversive agents, what the military called the VCI, Viet Cong Infrastructure, by which they meant the National Liberation Front, I guess. I would bug military briefers when they would use this term, VCI. What does VCI mean? It means Viet Cong Infrastructure. What is the word in Vietnamese for this? What is the word the Vietnamese use? Well, I don't know. I don't think they use VCI. That's right, they don't. This was part of our definition of the enemy. We didn't define the other side clearly. We went on using terms that were meaningless, and this simply led, compounded the error of confusion. The really heart of the VCI and the so-called neutralizing was called the Phoenix Program. I'll talk about that later, but very briefly, the Phoenix Program was a program to isolate and neutralize subversive agents. It was an assassination program against Viet Cong cadres. It was based on the philosophic assumption that people who came down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to send other people out to fight and die should not be sacrosanct. They should not be neutral, and they should not be sacred cows. That anybody who does this all the way back up to Ho Chi Minh is a definable, legitimate target. If we can kill them, we should do it. And it's not anything unethical, it's simply the way warfare is. It's, of course, it's the basic, you cut off the head, that was the basic principle of it. The Phoenix Program has had a very bad reputation among American historians. I could never see why. It was a program that was misused sometimes, and that's a fair criticism, but you can say that of almost any strategy. It was developed really from what the British did in Malaya, with what they called the CTs, the communist terrorists. They had a card file, which is before computer days, in which they had the name of every CT in Malaya. All of these guys were Chinese, and the war and insurgency in Malaya was run by the Chinese, or Chinese ethnics, out of Chinese village. Very clear-cut identification of who the enemy is. They weren't all Chinese. I mean, some Chinese were pro-Malayan, but almost all, I think, of them were. Anyway, through a very remarkable intelligence and low level of the tactical intelligence the British had assembled through their political officers in all that, and they've been there, of course, for 100 years, and each of these political officers in each province, in each district, knew their district like the back of their hand. They knew who the Chinese insurgents were, even though they didn't know where they were. They were up in the hills. They knew who they were. So they had a complete list almost of every insurgent. And it wasn't a very big list. It was maybe 1,200. That was the total. And so their whole campaign was to get these guys out of the war, one way or another. They would drop leaflets on them saying, if you want to come out, this is the black bag operation, we'll give you a bag of gold, and we'll send you any place you want to go. Go to China, go to Singapore. We just want you out of the hills and stop fighting. They also had assassination teams that would go in to try to find these people. They didn't come out. One case I heard of, that Li Fu Mu, while we were up in the hills, his wife had a baby in Singapore, and they weren't sure how long it had been since Li had been back to Singapore, but they knew where he was, so they dropped a leaflet on him and said, Li, your wife just had this baby. We suggest that you come out, either to go home and visit them, or to come home and get the guy who impregnated your wife. And he got out, and I never did hear what happened when he got back to Singapore. Anyway, it was very sophisticated kind of intelligence. Couldn't do it in Vietnam. We didn't have the intelligence. We didn't have the base. But the basic principle of this program, which I guess you have to decide whether it's ethical or not, was a way to destroy the top leadership. And that was made a very major part of the Abrams strategy. The keystone of the strategy is, though, still area security. That concept was seen as evolutionary, not revolutionary, that was built on what was learned in earlier cases, including going back to Iodrang Valley. So area security orients the strategy. This is a quote, on providing security for the Vietnamese people. Combined Vietnamese and American operations are emphasized. These operations will gradually become all Vietnamese as their forces move to the outer reaches of South Vietnam and as the U.S. moves to a role of securing its own forces and its own implement and its own installations. In implementing area security, the Vietnamese countryside is delineated into areas and zones. Criteria here is the degree of security afforded the population. So within these zones that are divided up, you determine whether what A, B, C are the two degrees of security or lack of it. Which is it, and what is the trend in your daily analysis of where things are going in that area? An important change that was made is that within any of these established areas or zones, there was a single individual responsible for the resources of security. That was an American. And it removed some of the responsibility from the Vietnamese, which was bad, but it also increased, I think, the application of this force system in more meaningful terms. Arvin units operated in a mobile role, primarily in what was called the clearing zone. Territorial forces, RF and PF, and also the National Police and what was called the People's Self-Defense Force, which was static defenders in the villages, these operated in the secure areas and in some of the consolidation zones. Emphasis will be placed on maintaining security in secure areas and increasing the level of security in the consolidation zone. Pacification, quote, in depth will be aggressively pushed. Tactics of saturation ambush and continuous small patrolling to be stressed. The neutralization of the subversive of the VCI will be stressed to cut the links between the enemy units and the people. The strategy seeks to create by providing an atmosphere which the Vietnamese government can expand its authority and strengthen itself. It does not ignore the threat posed by the enemy's combat forces, but if they can be isolated so they cannot reach the people, then they will not pose as a threat. That's what the area security seeks to prevent. The strategy will enable the Vietnamese government to expand its authority and grow stronger. Will make the security of South Vietnam progressively less dependent on outsider assistance and should ultimately result in a Vietnam that is able to maintain itself with outside assistance. All right, much of that, as I said, comes from Douglas Kennard. This is more of my thoughts, I think. First, to recap, the first operational priority was defense of population centers by static guard duty or local security operations. Second priority went to offensive actions which sought chronic disruption of the enemy's war-making capability or potentiality. This involved pushing the guerrilla back from the areas adjacent to the population center, but doing it without major combat, or if major combat was required, by military sweep operations and by clearing operations, chiefly by Arvin. Or if it involved seeking battle in a search and destroy operation, which usually involved the Americans, this would be the third level of trying to push the enemy back. Now, lots of these activities were combined with addressing the problem of off the battlefield challenged by the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese, what we call civic action work. There are a whole range of these, things such as called the country fair, or the cordon and search operation. They were designed to provide to the villagers where they operated token GVN social services, separating the guerrilla from the cadre and the cadre from the villagers. Country fair, for example, would bring in music and entertainment. They'd bring in doctors to treat people. They bring in well diggers and the textbooks they pass out to the teachers, all sorts of things in the name of the GVN, and designed to show the people that the GVN really cares about you people and you should support them. The real problem was that the villager wanted to support them, that they couldn't if you had VC in their midst. That was what Phoenix was supposed to do. Search out the one device they used, again, I'll go into this later, but which was used in Malaysia, which I think did work, was what was called the Black Tent Operation. And as part of this country fair, or a cordon and search operation, they would come in and set up, in some cases, actually a black tent. And then they would say to all these people in the village, which are quite small, 800-900 people, or maybe they have 2 or 3 tents if they were bigger than this, say, all right, we want each one of you to go through this tent and talk to the GVN official there, usually from the district level. And he will ask you all sorts of questions. And so if you don't want to talk, you don't have to. You can just sit there. But each one will be in there about 10 or 15 minutes. So people seeing you come out, they don't know whether you've been talking or not. And he's the only one there, and there's no tape recorders. He may take some notes, but what we want to know is, are there VC in this village, cavities, that we don't know about? And do you want to finger them? And do you want us to take care of them? And so these people would go through the village, go through the tent, and at the end there'd be this long pause, and then the GVN people would get together, and then they'd suddenly go out and they'd grab 2 or 3 people. And half the time, I found out later, they knew who these were before they went in. But they're really trying to gather some corroboration from the village. And the villagers did say yes, so these were the guys that they got. But the VC never knew whether anybody in the village fingered them or not. They could not come in and retaliate. Sometimes they would. They'd come in and just shoot up the village because somebody here fingered them, even if nobody actually did, if this intelligence was based on information they had before they arrived. It was quite an effective way, very time-consuming, and not entirely trustworthy, because you get these villagers who said, well, this Mr. Fu is a VC, and you found out later that this guy and Mr. Fu had had a big fight for years over land, and he wasn't a VC at all. It's just Mr. Fu wanted to get rid of him, so he fingered him. It was a very duplicitous activity. Anyway, this is illustrative of the kind of techniques that were tried to work out to deal with using the advantages that the GVN had, non-military advantages, in order to try to win the war. Basic purpose, of course, was to eliminate the Viet Cong infrastructure and the movements within the village. That was the objective of it. By its very nature, there was in all of this a high cast of defensiveness about Allied strategy. Absent, very much absent, was the traditional objective of warfare, unconditional surrender, which, for example, in Vietnam would have dictated invasion of North Vietnam. There were tactical innovations newly developed or borrowed from earlier wars, such as Malaya or the Philippines, which maximized the Allied advantages had. They had a great advantage in air power, new uses for the helicopter, B-52 bomber. Also, accurate modern artillery, use of rockets, other ordnance like that. Many of the guerrillas' former assets became liabilities. The helicopter made the U.S. Army and ARVN more mobile than they were, and the guerrillas' remote jungle lair, once prized for inaccessibility, became, because of hellebore raids and B-52 bombings, a more dangerous place to be than on the outskirts of Saigon, which they couldn't get that way. Jungle secrecy was torn away by electronic sensors that could report the slightest movement, by infrared photography, which could locate campfires or warm truck engines through clouds or foliage, and by the Rome plow, which removal of the jungle. These were huge 2.5-story bulldozer operations, the monstrous things that came in and just chewed up the jungle back and forth, usually along the road or any zone D, the very bad news areas of the VC. VC movement, freedom of movement, the guerrilla movement, was curtailed by monitored interdiction from interlocking fire sort devices. The sensors would tell them where the enemies were, and they had this fire-based support system that could then train their guns on whatever area that was involved. We used to hire Montagnard at these supermarket counters to sit on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and when the trucks went by, they would punch this supermarket carrier, and then at the end of the day, give it to the carrier, and he would see how many trucks the guy had counted. I always had trouble with that. I'd say, what were the trucks carrying? Well, we don't know that. We just knew that how many were going down. Did you know if one is going down, coming back, going down, coming back? You're counting the same truck 5 times. No, we didn't know that either. We just knew how many trucks were coming down. And I said, well, what was the value? Well, it would indicate if there was a buildup. There's lots of traffic on the trail, it indicates there's a buildup and that there's going to be a big offensive. So we did some research on that and went back to earlier traffic and earlier offensive and found that the correlation was very low. If there'd be a big buildup and it was sometimes followed by an offensive, big buildup and it wasn't followed. And nothing happened, all of a sudden suddenly there was a big offensive. And what the reason was that it's bringing it back and forth was stockpiling it all the way down. So they didn't have to have a lot of traffic to signal that that a change of strategy or operations was coming. That's General Jaffe, a genius at moving forces around the battlefield and supplies. But this removal of the jungle and all of this technology, which lots of Westerners made fun of, with a couple of books making fun of it, I didn't find it humorous at all, and I found, also in talking to Viet Cong detectives, I found they took it very seriously. One of them saying, well, we no longer own the night. They were very much afraid of these flare ships, and Puff, the Magic Dragon, huge searchlights and flares that would illuminate targets for artillery and gunship. And the VC advantage in surprise hit-and-run attack was countered by very rapid artillery and air support, plus quick reinforcement of the installation under attack. No matter where it was in Vietnam, it was hit late in the war. There was supplies and support coming in from the air, from the ground, from artillery at a distance, and so on. It changed the nature of the war. The biggest change, I think, had to do with the ambush, which is the basic tool used in guerrilla war. And the Viet Cong raised the ambush to a high art. And the Americans did the same thing, I would say, for counter-ambush. An ambush is a high art. It's not just two machine guns from the side of the road pointing down the road. It's two machine guns there, it's two machine guns behind, it's maybe two rocket artillery from some distance, and then after the ambush is over, there is a break-off as all the ambushers go across country and the enemy comes after them, and then they are ambushed by a counter-ambush ambush. It's almost like a chess game. And both sides know this game is played, and both sides is thinking, you know, you've been ambushed a couple of times, you get smart about it. Anyway, the Americans and the South Vietnamese devised a whole series of counter-ambushes, techniques. One was called the pylon tactic, which was simply very rapid fire support, very quick relief to convoys in ambush. The convoys were told the The one thing you don't do if you're in a convoy and you run into an ambush is stop. That's the worst thing you can do. Keep going. If there's something in the road, and there will be something in the road, hit it. Hit it wide open. Hit it whether it turns your vehicle over or not. But do not sit there and let them pick you up. Go around it. Go across country. Try to back up, but do not stop. And so, mostly what they would do, they'd go for the ditches that was on a road, or go for the banks that was in a canal, and call for air support and fire support, quick relief, and it would come in very quickly. They had rapid reaction teams all over the country, and if you could tell them clearly where you were, and that was the main problem, that you could count on quick reaction. And the people ambushing, you don't want to continue the ambush when the choppers are coming in. This is a game they can't win, so they just break off another day. So they also had what were called roadrunner operations, in which they used tanks and armored cars to flush out ambushes. They thought there was an ambush there, you send in a vehicle that's too big to blow up and flush out the ambushes. They also used suppressive air and artillery strikes against probable ambush sites and defoliation of road and canal ways which reduce such sites. You can't ambush from everywhere. You have to pick out good ambush sites, and if you can hit them in a suppressive fire, you can reduce the number of potential ambushes that they will run against you. I remember driving up through the highlands in Malaysia to this was long after the war. This war we went for a vacation from Vietnam, Cameron Highlands. And there were places along the road where they had signs indicating that this had been a battle during the Malaysian War. And you could see what ideal ambush sites they were. You know, high mountains, people are up there, they've got a back door to go out of, and there you are in the shooting gallery as you go along the road. So the Chinese ran into in North Vietnam when they invaded North Vietnam in 1989, and they were up against troops that had been trained in the south as ambushes. They were fine troops to use against the Chinese regulars who knew how to ambush and give the Chinese a real bloody nose. Anyway, there was this whole technology of ambush and counter-ambush. We had bushwhackers who went out and ambushed the ambushers at night. We had combat tracker teams that used dogs and guerrilla techniques, pursued guerrillas after ambushes for long distances. I remember the story once that there was this Viet Cong who were disguised as Arvin, the Arvin uniform thing, and they were ambushed by an Arvin unit that was disguised as Viet Cong. Did you get that? The American military set for itself the principle, often ignored in the exigencies of the situation, that the South Vietnamese government was responsible for non-military aspects of the struggle. That is, we're not talking about military actions now, but countering the NLF's political, Dao Chan, and its various Van programs. This was lumped under the general term of pacification. We hoped that it would be able to make the war against, we could make the war against the Pavan, the North Vietnamese, and in North Vietnam from the air, and leave the rest of it to the South Vietnamese. There was something of a division of the labor achieved, but we could never really unscramble this omelet of revolutionary guerrilla war. So intermixed is armed struggle and political struggle, that there was no, in most cases, unless it's a big battle that's underway, there's no way to distinguish what is armed struggle and what is political struggle. Finally, just a bit about the air war. And I'm really at a loss here to understand this, our strategy in North Vietnam and air power. The helicopter revolutionized warfare. The question of using B-52 bombers in a guerrilla war almost was an oxymoron when we heard it first introduced. They did find some uses for it. And they did find some uses, of course, in North Vietnam. The trouble with the strategic bombing in North Vietnam is they didn't have any targets to speak of. I think I mentioned that in the first target analysis that was done by the Pentagon in 1965, when they were considering strategic bombing in the North, they used the criteria that were used in World War II against Germany and Japan. What is to be bombed, what targets are strategic and which aren't. And in North Vietnam, they found 5 targets, which they said we can take out in one afternoon, and that's it. But there were political reasons for bombing the North and psychological reasons, so we found other reasons for bombing them. Anyway, very briefly, this is the record of air interdiction, as it was called, in Indochina. It began actually in Laos in 1964, extended to North Vietnam 9 months later. Bombing of North Vietnam was divided into 5 phases. First, March 1965, which continued with significant pause timing, both because of weather and because of peace proposals, until October 68. The halt, which were later curtailed in June of that year. Thereafter, until April of 72, carried out the third phase of the bombing, limited interdiction, or what were called, quote, protective reaction raids. The fourth phase began in April of 1972, following the North Vietnam's Easter Offensive in South Vietnam, and continued until October of 72. The fifth and final phase was the 12-day strategic bombing campaign from 18 to 30 December 1972, the so-called Christmas bombings, in which, to a civilian, this was the one action of strategic bombing that made sense to me. We had in Paris, we had an agreement more or less nailed down, wasn't a very good one, in late November of 72, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I think on the 28th, and the next morning the Vietnamese came in, the North Vietnamese, with a whole new set of codicils that they wanted to add. This is a standard technique in negotiating. You think you've got the guy negotiating, he's given you everything he wants, so you add a little more. If he doesn't take it, fine. If he does, all the better. Well, we said, no, this is it. Now, either you're going to buy into this or we're going back to the war. And they said, well, we don't think you can do that. And Kissinger was talking to Lazon privately about this mad bomber, Richard Nixon. I don't know if I can control the guy. And he's just going to go ape. So I'm telling you, you better settle. And it was a poker game. They bluffed, we bluffed. In the end, they called our bluff. In the end, we returned to all-out bombing. And this was the first time that there was really full-scale aerial warfare in North Vietnam. The Vietnamese in Hanoi thought they'd been getting the worst that the air power could give them, but they didn't see and didn't know what full air power could do. And they got this demonstration in 12 days, and it turned them around just like that. We went back to the conference table, and they said, okay, we'll sign off, and so on. You know, nothing ventured, nothing lost. Well, that's not really the interpretation the Air Power Association would put on the war. I'm probably not doing it great justice. But again, my purpose here was mostly to introduce you to what the Americans thought they were doing, allies thought they were doing, without evaluating it particularly, which will come in the future election, lectures. So, are there any questions? Do I hear any disgruntled murmurs in the back of the room? No? No? Nobody? We don't have any Air Force people in here. Any flybys? You weren't a flyby, were you? Huh? Yeah. You are a grunt, right? A front slope guy. Well, I feel a little better. I think I was in Korea and during the war working for the UN, and I felt we were sold a bill of goods by the Air Force about the outcome of that war. When we found out after the war that the North Vietnamese were never short of supplies of MLR. So we were told by the Air Force they were very hard up for ammunition. They weren't ever hard up. We were just sold a bill of goods. So I brought that same suspicion to Vietnam. That was why I was distrusting of the Air Force. Not some of my best friends are Air Force.